You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
The statistics on childhood sexual abuse are alarming. Research conducted by the Centers for Disease Control estimates that approximately 1 in 6 boys and 1 in 4 girls are sexually abused before the age of 18.
Our next guest shared his experiences coming out as gay in 1970s Wisconsin in his memoir, My Queer Life. In his second memoir, Empty Playground, A Survivor's Story, Callan Hardy shares his recovery from childhood sexual abuse. Callan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So you grew up in the small town of Schulzburg, Wisconsin, in the Driftless region, and your family had really deep roots there. Tell us about your early childhood.
My family did have really deep roots there. They settled in 1827, which was well before Wisconsin statehood. So I grew up in this town that our family was part of that history. Very small town, Irish Catholic. My family was Irish Catholic. Half the town was Methodist. Half the town was Catholic. There were a couple other little things in there. So very strict Roman Catholic upbringing with my mother. My father had died when I was 2 years old. So I was the only child in my class growing up in a single-parent household at that time, which is very uncommon back then, but not so much now.
And you talk about the town having all these protected buildings. It's a very idyllic, kind of idealized Wisconsin American setting. But for you, around the age of 9 or 10, that all really changed.
It did. It is a very beautiful town. There's 50 buildings on the Register of Historic Sites, the National Register. But one of the things that I mentioned in the book is sometimes behind those buildings, behind those curtains, you don't know what's going on. And that it's not just in Schulzburg. That's in cities all across the country. One in six boys and 1 in 4 girls, as Veronica mentioned, are being abused. So when I was 9, I was touched. When I was 10, some more serious things started happening. And that lasted all the way till I was 17 and a half years old.
And you decided very consciously in this book to talk specifically about who had abused you and to be precise in your descriptions of the abuse. Why was that important to you?
I think it's easy for people to disassociate. It's easy to look at somebody who's in their 50s and not see the child who was hurt. So whenever I do speaking engagements, I always show a photograph of what I looked like when I was 10, so that people understand that. I think it's also easy to say, you know, you're an adult, get over it. But when people hear the description of what really happened, I think they understand that's not something you get over with real easily. So I thought it was important to not incorporate all the raw stuff, but some detail about what really happened so that would be understood. Because I think it's awfully easy to think the least possible harmful thing.
To sanitize it in your own mind.
Yes. And I think as a country, as a state, as a city, wherever we happen to be, we have a big problem with this. And I think we really, really need to talk about it. And we need to talk about it openly and honestly, or it's never going to end.
So your abuser was your older brother, Kevin. And he was enough older than you that you were still really a child, and he was more moving into his early and mid-teen years and then into his 20s by the time the abuse ended. So here's your older brother who you admired and loved, and then the abuse started and continued. How did you try to reconcile that in your child mind?
I didn't know how to. You have it's almost Christmas time. You have family celebrations. You have birthdays, Christmases, where the whole family's together and loving each other. And yet, in the background, in my mind, those things were happening, and I was remembering them. So it was hard, and you never knew when it might happen again. When that person is living in your household, that makes it incredibly difficult, because mom goes to the grocery store or goes to church, and you're there alone. Something might happen. It might not. You never knew. So, and the trust issue is huge when it's a family member. One of the reasons I felt it was important to name that relationship in the book was because I think there's this notion out there that there's creepy guys in vans or hanging around school grounds who are going to kidnap your child. And that is such a small percentage of what happens. The vast majority of the time is a close family member, a trusted adult, a neighbor, friend, somebody the child knows and really trusts, and the family knows and really trusts. And oftentimes when it's revealed, families or other people don't believe it even happened. They refuse to believe the child.
We're talking with Callan Hardy about his most recent memoir, Empty Playground, A Survivor's Story. And Callan, you did what we teach our children to do in a situation like that. You told someone about what was happening and what was the result.
That's a very hard memory still. I wrote a play a few years ago about this as well called Invisible Boy. But I told the first time something happened, I tried to tell my mother that I was touched down there. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me and she said, oh, you shouldn't let him do that to you. So that put the onus on me. I took that in. I took the blame. I let him do that is what I felt. So then when something more serious happened, I did not go back to her. And being a good Catholic boy, I should have gone to confession if I had done something wrong, but I couldn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. That's not something I could have told the priest or, mm-hmm. and if I told my mother and she didn't know how to deal with it, who else was I going to tell?
But in that moment also, you saw something in your mother's eyes.
I did.
That made you think that perhaps this was an experience that she had had herself.
She went away. I think she dissociated at that moment. I was looking at her and she was somewhere else. And at 10 years old or 9, I'm not sure exactly what old age I was when that happened, I sort of knew in my heart that something had happened to her when she was younger.
Is that something that you were ever able to revisit with her?
I asked her about it. She said, I don't know. I don't think so. I think that she may have blocked it out if something did happen. And now she's 90 years old and has dementia, so I can't talk to her about things like that at all.
Your book is called Empty Playground, A Survivor's Story. What does the empty playground represent for you?
That comes from, there was a moment when I was in high school, in the school cafeteria in Shelbury High School, looks out to the playground, and it was wintertime. There was nobody on the playground, snow all over the place, swings blowing in the wind a little bit. And in my entire life, I've always thought of things symbolically, and I looked at that, and it represented to me that childhood that I had lost when I was younger. I wrote that into a poem several years later with the line, there's nothing more tragic than a deserted playground. So I decided to use that as the title of the book, but also the subtitle is A Survivor Story. I'm a survivor, I'm not a victim, and I'm doing everything I can to make sure there are no more victims.
And so being abused by a male made your process of accepting and embracing being a gay man that much more complicated. Can you share a little bit of how you were able to finally tease out that abuse in your childhood and your sexuality as an adult?
Yeah, I think being abused by a man, whether you're gay or straight, brings up a lot of questions about sexuality. There's many a straight man who was abused by a man who questioned their sexuality even though they're very straight, because it makes you wonder, did I do something to invite this? I've had those thoughts as well, but as I was coming out, I also realized that I had boy crushes before that ever started happening. I remembered a crush that I had in second grade on another boy, and that was several years before anything like that had ever happened. So little by little, in piecing those bits together, I realized that my sexuality had nothing to do with that abuse, and I didn't invite it because I was gay. I didn't become gay because of it. And a lot of people misunderstand that. I think it's a very important thing for people to know that those are two absolutely separate things. One doesn't cause the other or vice versa.
So you said that for you it's really important to identify, instead of being a victim, as being a survivor. Is there a point that you feel like you made that transition yourself, or was it a really, I know it was a long process coming to terms with the abuse and even remembering a lot of the abuse, but is there a point where you felt, I'm a survivor, I have survived this?
Yeah, I think after I survived my heart attack, after the heart attack is when I wrote the play about it. It's when I decided I needed to face this and deal with it and also share that story so that others might be able to deal with their stories as well. So that was probably about only 5 years ago, so already into my 50s. A lot of people take decades to be able to deal with this kind of thing.
And I want to make sure people know your play Invisible Boy, which is a lot of this same material that you draw on for your memoir, Empty Playground, is actually available on YouTube.
On Vimeo.com.
Vimeo.
Yep.
So they can just search
Invisible Boy or my name, Callan Hardy, and they can find that.
Well, Callan, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Wisconsin author and playwright Callan Hardy. His new memoir is called Empty Playground, A Survivor's Story.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.